Hello and welcome to EDUCAUSE Now. On this episode of EDUCAUSE Now, we talk about the new skills needed for the success of an IT organization. And we speak with Diane Harley from UC Berkeley about how scholarly communications vary wildly between disciplines. Whether you are talking about an IT organization or an employee at that organization, strong technical skills alone are no longer a sufficient condition for success. And while tech skills will always contribute to your credibility as an IT professional, it is no longer the only skill you need to perfect. Timothy Chester is Vice Provost and CIO for Pepperdine University. He says to understand this shift in skill sets, one must put it within the context of how IT organizations have evolved over time.
The challenge of the 1970s and the 1980s was data processing. The challenge of the 1980s was very much about getting all buildings on campus wired for networking and getting a PC on the desktop of every faculty member and then eventually every staff member. Okay, that's when the leaders of IT were called the director of the Computing Services Center. With the internet and the late 1990s and early 2000s, the challenge was taking advantage of the net to deliver content, services, and information in a personalized way to your faculty, students, and staff. Most institutions went about that by doing ERP implementations. The challenges of today are vitally different. The challenge of today is how are we to be effective with all of this technology? It really is a shift from an emphasis on high-speed networking in the technical sense to high-quality relationships with faculty, students, and staff.
In other words, it's no longer about information or technology. It's what we do with IT that counts. And that pursuit takes a fundamentally different skill set than the past.
Thought leaders make decisions about what's appropriate. They strategize, they plan. And at the end of the day, with that expertise and with the business smarts, they're able to play a role, an advisory and consultative role, in those domain areas outside of IT. Presidents, provosts, and CFOs want IT leaders and the IT organizations to play those advisory and consultative roles.
Thomas Friedman, in his New York Times column entitled "The New Untouchables," wrote this about our new economy, quote, "Just being an average accountant, lawyer, contractor, or assembly line worker is not the ticket it used to be. Vanilla doesn't cut it anymore. It's all about what chocolate sauce, whipped cream, and cherry you can put on top. So our schools have a doubly hard task now, not just improving reading, writing, and arithmetic, but entrepreneurship, innovation, and creativity." Unquote. So you've got this theory, you understand the concept, and you see the goal. But what's next? How do you motivate your organization to move in this direction? Again, Tim Chester.
At Pepperdine, we do about three different things. First, we're honest and we have honest conversations with our staff about the impacts of globalization, about the impacts of this great recession on resources and expectations. Second, we've built out a reorganized set of career ladders that align with this new reality and emphasize competency development just as much as progressive technical experience. For each position now that we've got in our career ladder, in addition to those skills and experience requirements, there are progressive requirements in terms of competency mastery. And for each position, there is about 9 competencies required. And only one of those competencies is around information systems knowledge. Okay? We make about 95% of our hiring, performance, merit review, and retention decisions based on competency performance as opposed to basing them on project delivery. What we strive to do is to always hire at the bottom of our career ladders and promote people up through the top. The third thing we do to motivate our organization is we rigorously use benchmarking and assessment data gathered through the Higher Education Tech Qual Project. This data tells us what our faculty and students think from their point of view about our technology services. And we use that data to represent what we should be doing, what we're doing well, the opportunities that we have, and frankly, the things that we need to fix from time to time.
If you'd like to find out more specific information, such as more detail about the competencies Pepperdine encourages, you can find a link to Tim Chester's presentation entitled "Competencies Drive Successful Technology Organizations" in the show notes at www.educause.edu/now.
Catch catch up on the latest issues in higher ed IT by tuning into free interactive EDUCAUSE Live web seminars. I'm Steve Worona, EDUCAUSE Director of Policy and Networking Programs and the host of EDUCAUSE Live. Join me, along with thought leaders in our community, for hour-long discussions on topics such as web accessibility, intellectual property and copyright, and digital visual literacy. Learn about upcoming seminars or listen to our archives at www.educause.edu/live.
The variety of disciplines represented in higher education point to the assortment of different ways that scholars publish and communicate their ideas. An astronomer doesn't show his research outcomes in the same way a historian might. So each discipline creates a set of needs and practices unique unto themselves. And since 2005, Diane Harley and her team at the University of California, Berkeley, with funding from the Mellon Foundation, have been studying the needs and practices of seven disciplines across several elite research institutions to show that disciplinary conventions matter. I recently spoke with Diane Harley and started by asking her what disciplines the study covered.
The fields are archaeology, astrophysics, biology, economics, history, music, and political science. Mm-hmm. And in those fields, we talked to a variety of faculty. We ended up sampling about 45 different institutions. We focused almost exclusively on elite research universities. In addition to that interviewing process, we also did a lot of background research, attended meetings such as CNI, ARL, and did site visits to various places.
Could you talk a little bit about discipline-specific trends?
When we chose the disciplines, we thought about a variety of issues. We knew with astrophysics that they rely on massively expensive telescopes and satellites. These are shared resources. They're usually federally funded, some foundation funding. Massive amounts of data are produced from these sensors, if you will. Faculty congregate around those. They also, interestingly, publish in the archive, which is the physics, astrophysics, math, disciplinary repository for preprints. So that's a very specific kind of academic culture. Now, compare that, for example, to biology. First, biology is a huge field with many, many subfields. Some people say that it's the age of biology. We tended to focus on molecular and cell biology, very fast-moving field, very, very well-funded. Different kind of model than the astrophysics, for example, in that it's the PI lab model, if you will. There's a single PI, there are postdocs, graduate students, and so on, working in a lab. There's simply no preprint culture in this field. However, the turnaround time in the publication process is very, very rapid. A paper is submitted, it's reviewed, it can be published, you know, within months. So there's not a lot of early sharing of working papers or preprints. Now, compare that to history. Again, you know, we're looking at a very different kind of field, humanities or social science, depending on what institution you're talking about. It will be in one or the other of those two. It's a book-based field. We know that. There are lots of different ways in which historians communicate with one another, both in progress and final archival. But the book is the gold standard, if you will, for historical scholarship. Now, the book has many different kinds of qualities than the journal article. History takes a long, long time, and the value that we heard in the book was that it allowed for a long argument. It allowed for the exposition of an argument with all the supporting materials. So I could, you know, music, it presented its own, as you can well imagine. Musicology is a very complex field. It is not one field, as we discovered. There's the art, historical, Western tradition part of it, which is very standard humanities book-based. There's music theory, which has many overlaps with mathematics. There is ethnomusicology, which has many overlaps, as you can imagine, with anthropology. And then there's computer-generated music. And there's also an art practice component. Now, again, this will how that's organized on a campus will vary significantly. But given all of those, if you will, traditions, there's a lot of variation in what's considered to be a publication. That could be a book, can be a journal article, it can be video from the field in ethnomusicology. It can be a CD or an MP3. So that's a very complex field, if you will, that gave us a lot of clues as to where it might be going in the future. And when we chose these fields, we were interested in current practices around the whole scholarly communication lifecycle. But we were also interested in trying to assess what a trajectory might look like in a network age with the evolution of various technologies.
So in practical terms, what sort of influence would you like to see this study have? What problems or concerns with faculty and research might this study address?
When you see that there's a potential for the disciplines to look at their own practices and ask themselves, perhaps, well, can we fix this? Can we fix some of these systems that may be somewhat broken? And that goes to the tenure and promotion system. It goes to how that is related to the publishing process, the way in which archival publications become proxies for quality. So there are a whole host of issues that it's pretty messy. And I think if we can start a conversation within the disciplines to look at their own practices and reform those parts of the process that need reforming, then I feel that we've been quite successful.
So where can people go to look at this report?
Well, we published open access. This is a big report. Total, it's about 700-plus pages. It's broken. It's been sliced and diced, so if somebody's interested in biology, they don't have to go into the whole 700-page report. So that's available on eScholarship. You can get it from our website at the Center for Studies in Higher Education. It's linked from our scholarly communication project or from my personal homepage. We also just finished creating a print-on-demand version with UC Press. So if someone is interested, and we've had some interest from libraries in particular of getting a hard copy, it can be ordered as a hard copy with print-on-demand.
Great. Well, Diane Harley, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Jerry.
Diane Harley, Principal Investigator and Director of the Higher Education in the Digital Age Project at the University of California, Berkeley. If you'd like to find out more about the stories and people we bring you on EDUCAUSE Now, you can visit the show notes at www.educause.edu/now. That's where you'll find links to studies, articles, and presentations featured in this podcast. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE. Thanks for listening.